Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Motherhood is still very new for Eliza Erickson.
Yes. We're nine and a half weeks now. 9 weeks. Yeah.
So who do you have on your lap?
So this is another Maiken. Everyone in Philadelphia is very excited that there's another Maiken. So Maiken Faye, she was born January 12th.
Oh. Maiken is not happy.
Can I feed her? Is
of
that
course.
Okay? Okay. That's what you want. We're going to give the authentic new mom experience.
The baby starts to nurse, and I ask Eliza how she's been feeling since becoming a mom, her health.
I was really surprised at kind of how much emphasis I think there is on being healthy during pregnancy and kind of not enough focus on what the physical recovery is like. And your body is like super ravaged after birth. I really had to learn to give my body time to heal in a way that I haven't done in the past. So, you know, I was home from the hospital and day two, I wanted to go take my dog for a walk. And it was really, really hard to face the fact that I couldn't do things like that. I think kind of mentally and emotionally, you learn also very quickly that your body isn't your own anymore. You don't have the luxury necessarily of being on your own schedule with your own ownership anymore, which again is super amazing, but also I think has its tough, like frustrating pain points.
Eliza says overall, she's definitely taking very good care of herself now.
I need to be the best version of myself so I can be the best version of her mom.
How about the joy of being a mom? Were there any elements of it that have surprised you so far?
Yes, basically the whole thing has surprised me. Just generally, like how happy she has made me and how it is super fulfilling to be a mom.
I also got to meet Eliza's mom and Maiken's grandmother, Amy Pollock. She shared this memory.
Very shortly after I found out I was pregnant, I started wearing a seatbelt. And I had never worn a seatbelt regularly until that time. And I think that it was the beginning of a mind shift that I was now responsible for another human being.
Pregnancy and motherhood changes your lifestyle and your body in major ways. As a society, we often focus on looks, the ridiculous notion that you should immediately get your pre-pregnancy body back and show off your perfect abs. But there are all of these internal changes, long-lasting effects of motherhood that women have to get used to.
I had knee problems after I had him, feet problems.
My anxiety definitely got worse because I was able to get anxious for both myself and for and about my son. I would get anxious about his nursing, his eating, taking him places.
I had shingles, I had hives, and I had the flu.
I remember being very tired all the time.
On today's episode, we'll dig into the impact of birth and motherhood on women's health. Let's start in the maternity ward with those first few moments and days of motherhood. How moms and babies spend that time has changed a lot in recent decades. Newborns used to be separated from their mothers almost right away and sent to the hospital nursery. You've probably seen pictures of those rows of little bassinets behind viewing glass. But now, more and more nurseries are empty, and hospitals are keeping moms and babies together as much as possible. Jad Slayman looked into why.
Baby Calla has the hiccups. It's the day after she was born. Mom, Maria McCory, is holding her in the hospital bed.
She was with us for an hour before they even weighed her, and then we wheeled up to the room together, and she's been in here ever since. So she hasn't left at all.
For Maria, it's a comfort keeping her daughter close.
It's definitely exhausting, but I'm glad she's here. I mean, I'm breastfeeding her, so it's nice to be able just to have her right here with me. That makes it a lot easier. But yeah, I also kind of have that paranoid new mom thing, even though she's our third, where I want to make sure she's breathing constantly. So
keeping mom and baby together instead of using the nursery, it's part of an initiative called Baby Friendly Hospital. It's an international program that promotes breastfeeding. It's been adopted by hundreds of American birthing hospitals over the past decade. For the McCorys, it was a blessing, but it's not so blissful for everyone. Julie Kesselman became a mom a few months ago. It was a complicated birth, and she ended up having a C-section. Her baby was healthy, but mom wasn't.
I was just incredibly sick. I developed a fever. I was vomiting.
And her newborn son was right there in the room with her.
I remember feeling so distraught because I was just looking at him in the bassinet next to me, and I didn't even have the strength to pick him up and hold him.
Her husband was there, but he was exhausted too, and couldn't really move around because of a knee injury. Julie wanted to be there for her baby, but she says she didn't feel physically up to it.
There were times that I would just start crying uncontrollably. And I think those were the moments that I really thought, oh my gosh, I wish someone would just take him for an hour.
Julie says sending her baby to the nursery didn't seem like it was even an option. The hospital she delivered in, like at least 1/6 of all American birthing hospitals, is baby-friendly designated. Baby-friendly comes from WHO and UNICEF. It's aimed at increasing exclusive breastfeeding until a baby is 6 months old. That means no formula unless medically necessary. It calls for rooming in, keeping mom and baby together as much as possible, so that when baby's hungry, mom's right there to breastfeed.
I don't think anyone ever said, you know, oh, the baby's going to be in the room with you the whole time. It's because we're baby friendly.
Julie says being together meant staying awake, hour after hour, all night, all day. I heard a similar story from another mom who delivered at a different baby-friendly hospital.
I did the math and I slept only 5 hours in, I think, like 4 days.
She didn't want us to use her name because she felt humiliated by her experience. Her delivery was relatively smooth, but dad was working in another city, so mom was alone with her son.
But I definitely got my second, third, and even 10th wind while I was in there because I knew I had to be up and take care of him.
Every time her baby went in the bassinet, he cried. When he slept with her in the bed, nurses came and woke her up, saying sleeping together was dangerous. Staff were coming and going, performing tests on her baby. She wasn't producing much milk and wasn't given any formula. Basically, she couldn't catch a break.
Okay, I don't know if you want to put it in, it's kind of graphic, but there was one point where I really had to go to the bathroom, but I didn't know what to do with the baby. I was just freaking out, and he was freaking out, so...
She relieved herself on the floor.
I don't have enough hands.
Breastfeeding is important to lots of moms. Doctors agree it's the best thing for moms and babies. But rooming in, these sleepless nights right after delivery, is that necessary? And doctors are starting to worry about how safe all of this is. Could an exhausted mom fall asleep, accidentally smother a baby, or drop one?
For example, one of the requirements is that 80% of the babies needs to be at least 23 hours of the day with the mom.
That's neonatologist Enrique Gomez Pomar. He was struck by how strict baby-friendly policies seemed when they came to his hospital system in Meridian, Mississippi in 2016.
What happened when you have a mother that had a C-section, or what happened when you have a mother that was laboring for 2 days and is exhausted and she wants to rest and she wants somebody to help with the baby? And at that point, she doesn't have a significant other, or she doesn't have somebody that can help her in the room.
I tell Enrique about those two moms we heard earlier and others I talked to who had similar difficult experiences. He says these stories are common because giving moms a break, taking healthy babies to the nursery, is a ding against the baby-friendly designation.
And they are very strict on their numbers. And if you, for example, the mom said that she wants to rest, then you take the baby to the nursery, and then that case actually dings the hospital.
All right, So, baby friendly, what is it, where'd it come from, and why this focus on breastfeeding?
Yeah, hello, I'm Trish McEnroe. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Baby Friendly USA.
They're a nonprofit in charge of implementing the International Baby Friendly Program in the United States. They go to hospitals, train them in these 10 steps to successful breastfeeding in exchange for a fee.
It's a three-year process, and it's about approximately $12,000 for that three-year period of time.
A baby-friendly team goes to a hospital and makes sure they're having moms room in, make sure the hospital isn't advertising commercial formula, and in general is really promoting the benefits of breastfeeding and teaching moms how to do it. There's annual recertification.
You know, old practices die hard. So even in facilities that have gone through our process and have made the transformation, even post-designation, we ask them to continue to monitor their practices so that they don't backslide.
I bring up what those moms told me, how badly they just wanted to sleep, and the doctor's concerns. And I ask, basically, why not just offer up the nursery more, make it feel more like an okay choice?
The reality of mothers and babies being exhausted may not, the best answer may not always be separation of mothers and babies. That might be one solution, and that certainly should be used if necessary. Sometimes it is inviting the mother to have a support person alongside of her to help and just be vigilant and be supportive. And if the mom nods off, that support person can, you know, gently take the baby and put it back into a bassinet. So there's many, many different solutions.
She says really important bonding happens in those first hours after delivery. Moms start learning how to be moms, how to listen to feeding cues from their babies. If a baby doesn't start to breastfeed, mom might not be able to produce milk later. If you just whisk the baby away, give them formula while mom sleeps, you miss out on that. There's also anxiety. Lots of new moms dread being separated from their babies.
There are mothers that have reported that when their babies were in the nursery, they'd hear crying down the hall and they wondered if it was their baby.
Plus, formula costs about $30 a week, while breast milk is free and always at the right temperature. Breastfeeding can also help moms lose the baby weight. All of this is a complete 180 from how things were just a few decades ago. Babies were just taken away, checked into the nursery automatically. No one asked moms what they wanted, and formula seemed like a gift from science.
Introducing Good Start Supreme DHA and ARA, the only formula designed for babies' brain and eye development. And
with compared to that, breastfeeding was considered almost backward.
For a lot of women, it wasn't even really a choice. It was just sort of, you have your baby in the hospital, and then the nurses take it away to the nursery. They give it a bottle of formula.
That's Jessica Martucci. She's a researcher at the Science History Institute in Philadelphia, and author of Back to Breast. It's about how breastfeeding has made a comeback in the United States. Jessica tracks Baby Friendly's origins to the 50s, and a group called La Leche League, a grassroots group of moms that pushed back against formula. By the late 70s, they were well-respected, internationally known. Formula was still king in wealthy countries, but then major companies started marketing in the developing world. That raised some major red flags.
If an area doesn't have access to clean water, for example, like, is it ethical to ask people to buy formula that you need to mix with water that could then make their baby sick?
UNICEF, the WHO, were holding meetings amid all this. The league was there. We ended up with the 10 steps to successful breastfeeding, the basis of Baby Friendly. It officially launched in 1991 and spread across the world, but it didn't catch on in the U.S. at first. Here's Trish again, Baby Friendly's CEO.
I would say that things really started to take off in around 2010. And that really came about because there was a recognition about the relationship between breastfeeding and childhood obesity prevention. And as this country really embraced taking on that challenge and recognizing how the best, one of the key strategies for addressing obesity prevention is getting infant feeding off to a really good start.
When I ask WHO, UNICEF, why exclusive breastfeeding is so important in the United States, they also bring up long-term benefits. Dozens of studies have shown breastfeeding linked to lower rates of obesity and a wide range of other diseases, diabetes, cancer, asthma. Some even seem to find that breast milk makes kids smarter.
A large new study finds the longer that a baby is nursed, the higher their IQ, education, and income when they grow up.
Hear about enough of these, and breast milk can seem kind of magic. But with all these studies, you never have a true control group. You can't take a group of moms and randomly tell some to breastfeed and others not to. Without the control, you don't know if it's breast milk that's behind the benefits or
things like mother's education and family income.
That's Cynthia Collin, a population health researcher at Ohio State University. She says researchers try to control for these differences. They call them confounders. To minimize them, her team looked for siblings in families where one kid was breastfed and the other wasn't. They found nearly 1,800 cases like this.
What we found is that for the most part, there were no associations between breastfeeding and any of the outcomes.
There was no real difference between breast and formula fed when the kids were in the same family. I also spoke with social epidemiologist Michael Kramer. He's been working on a massive breastfeeding study in Eastern Europe. They randomized 31 hospitals. At some, they implemented baby-friendly protocols. The others, they left alone. Initial breastfeeding rates were already high. But at the baby-friendly hospitals, exclusive breastfeeding continued at 7 times the rate of the control hospitals. More moms were breastfeeding, and for much longer. A big part of baby-friendly is exclusive breastfeeding for a full 6 months. The study continued for 2 decades, tracking these babies as they became teenagers. Here's what they found, or more like what they didn't find.
We did not find any protective effect against obesity. We found no protective effect against allergic disease, against high blood pressure, or any metabolic indicators which might be considered as precursors of type 2 diabetes.
So what explains the benefits all those other studies found? Well, no one knows for sure, but both the researchers say something else must be at play when it comes to breastfeeding that we don't understand yet. Maybe something more than what's in the milk. Still, every single mom I spoke with for this story, even those opposed to baby-friendly, they all have one thing in common.
I am breastfeeding and I still am exclusively
breastfed all 4 of my children.
Pro-breastfeeding, which I am as well.
All of them breastfed. That's whether they believed breast milk was magic or only marginally better than formula. They say it's because they wanted to provide the absolute best for their babies. One of those new moms we heard from earlier said that didn't mean she wasn't going to use formula here and there.
One of the nurse practitioners at the OBGYN said to me, formula-fed babies go to college too. So, you know,
like that.
I'm all right with it.
That's a good move.
Yeah.
Jad Slayman reported that story. Women are more open about postpartum depression these days. Famous actresses and singers have been sharing their experiences. There's even a new drug to treat this issue. Even so, not enough women are getting help when they are struggling. And some women of color say the stereotypes they face mean they don't feel safe asking for help. Aneri Patani has this story.
Ariel Dickey always wanted to be a mom. Ariel is 27 and lives in Philadelphia's Germantown neighborhood with her partner and their daughter, Oma.
She's like so sweet and nurturing, like, whoa. Like if she sees me a little sad, she'll say, what's wrong? And she'll grab my face and kiss it.
Oma's too.
What color is it?
Green.
No, it's not green. What color is it?
Purple.
No, it's not purple.
Thinking back, Ariel says when maternity leave ended and she had to go back to work, the separation was overwhelming.
At my job, I remember sometimes I would be with my, like, talking to my boss and things, and I would have, like, this impulse of, like, I quit, you know, just because to me, in that moment, it's like, my time here isn't worth me being away from her.
The feeling continued for months.
And I used to have, like, breakdowns in the bathroom about it.
It was more than separation anxiety. But Ariel says she didn't dare utter the words postpartum depression. She was afraid of what people would think.
Oh, wait, postpartum depression, does that mean you might, like, you want to harm yourself and the baby? You know, like, that whole thing. I was scared because it's just like, what if they think I'm, like, a danger to us?
She felt like, as a Black woman, she might not get a second chance. She worried child welfare would assume she's a bad mom. And what if they took Oma away?
It's something that I've seen happen, like seeing growing up, hearing stories of moms that, you know, like they had their kid in like the most loving home and like for the slightest thing. Now you're under investigation. Now you're like, you know, it just didn't seem like a risk I was willing to take.
Eventually, the situation got so bad, she told her boss, and they helped her get therapy. Many women don't have that type of support. Research shows women of color are up to 3 times more likely to suffer postpartum depression, but less likely to get treatment. Alfie Breland-Noble is a psychiatrist at Georgetown University Medical Center. She says it makes sense that Black women worry about being judged more quickly and harshly.
What women of color, what they're experiencing and what they're reporting is either lived experience, you know, or the experience of people they know, or people in the neighborhood, or people in the community.
She researches depression in minority communities, and the evidence is out there. Studies at the state and national level have found child welfare workers judge Black mothers as unfit at a higher rate than white mothers, even when they have the same education and income level.
The threat, just the idea that that might be leverage, me having depression might be leverage for someone to take my child from me, you know, I wouldn't be the want to be the person who takes that chance.
That fear can lead some women to hide their symptoms.
What got me into this line of work is just my passion for helping others and giving them a voice.
That's Aisha Ukda. She works for a nonprofit in Philadelphia called the Maternity Care Coalition. She does home visits with women who have a high-risk pregnancy and screens them looking for signs of depression. The questionnaire includes statements like, "I've been able to laugh in the past 7 days," or "I've been so unhappy, I have difficulty sleeping." Aisha's clients score each statement. A score above 10 means the woman might need mental health services. Aisha remembers one client scored a 22 on the screening when she was pregnant. But after that same woman had the baby, she scored a 0, like there were no problems at all.
And I always see like a trend with a lot of my clients where if I did that screening before they had the baby, they're truthful with a lot of their answers. But then after they have the baby, they're a little more afraid and a little more timid.
About a month later, Aisha went to visit that mom again.
She kind of broke down and was crying during our whole entire home visit just because she was like, I was lying to you the first time that you came out. I really did need services and I just didn't want to admit it to you and myself.
Maternal health experts say underreporting of postpartum depression is a huge problem. Psychiatrist Alfie Breland-Noble adds, it would help for doctors to learn more about a patient's cultural background and provide more personalized care. But there's another challenge. The screening tools doctors use may not work as well for women of color.
There were very few people of color or women of color in the samples that helped us develop the tools. And so what we're stuck with is tools that weren't necessarily developed with these cultural nuances in mind.
They often have key words like depression or anxiety, but different communities use different language.
So they'll say, I have the blues, I'm in my feelings. I don't feel right. Something feels off. We have this old saying among Southern African Americans where people will say nothing ain't wrong, but something ain't right. You know what I mean? So it's just this uneasiness. So those are the kinds of things I've encountered with people where they will sort of talk around depression, but nobody really wants to say that what they have is a mental illness like depression.
Studies evaluating screening tools used for low-income African American mothers found they don't catch as many women as they should. Researchers say it'd be better to use lower cutoff scores for women of color so they don't fall through the cracks. Portia Smith was one of those women who should have been identified and linked to help. She had her daughter Nellie 19 years ago.
I really didn't have a connection with her. I didn't want to.
It was a time when there weren't clear recommendations directing doctors to screen all new mothers for depression. Portia was 18 then, living away from her family for the first time and in a relationship with an abusive partner.
And I could not imagine in a million years why I would breastfeed this baby. It was no way. Because that mean I would have to have her up connected to me. And I just, at the time being 18 years old, I just didn't want that.
She'd always been told being a mom was a magical experience. But it didn't feel that way. She found herself crying more than the baby.
She's crying all day, me too. We're both crying together.
It took Portia 6 months to work up the courage to seek care. But when she did, the doctor dismissed her symptoms as normal.
And I'm looking at him like, it's 6 months, 7 months after I had this baby. It's not getting any better.
Determined, she tried another clinic. There she finally got medication and counseling. Slowly, she started feeling better. And soon, she was connecting with Nelly. Today, Portia and her teenage daughter, Nelly, do their makeup together.
Turn that song. Like Cupid.
It's a big production. Bright lighting, a raised swivel chair, a black cape like the ones used at hair salons. And at the end of it, they take rounds of selfies.
Nelly, you was blinking. No. I always make it us be together. A brunch, a $5 movie. I don't care what it is. I make sure that we have that connection.
Now that she has it, she never wants to lose it again.
That's Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Aneri Patani. This story is part of a reporting collaboration with the Inquirer. For more information, visit our website at whyy.org. Pregnancy and motherhood impacts women's bodies and their health, and we wanted to hear your take on that. Here are some of the things women sent back to us.
My name is Kuna. I live in Washington, D.C. My kids are almost 11 months old and 2.5. I think that because my children are so young, becoming a mother has affected my health in a bad way. I went for about 9 months straight without having a single full night's sleep, and that's just recently tapering off. And I did the same thing for about a year with my daughter, and in between that I was pregnant, so sleep was difficult. I've been tired, but I can see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I also pick up more germs than I used to. So when my kids get sick, I tend to not get sick until the moment they get better, and then I get laid out pretty significantly. For example, when my son was 3 months old, I had shingles, I had hives, and I had the flu, all on top of each other at the same time. So that's not normal for me. I'm usually really healthy.
We asked women about the health effects of motherhood. Here's another recording we received.
My name is Maureen Mooney. He is 5 months old, and he's sweet and happy and a really awesome kid. I think that becoming a mother has made me healthier. First of all, I think I just don't have as much time to be unhealthy because our day-to-day has changed so much. And rather than going out to dinner or meeting up with friends all the time, you know, we're at home and we're spending time as a family and hanging out with the baby, and any extra time that we have, we prioritize sleep more than anything else. So by default, I think that I'm a little bit healthier because of that.
Hi, I'm Jen Herzig. I'm a mom and a marketer. I have a son who's almost 2. His name is Sam. We call him Clam. And he's pretty chill most of the time. I think that the biggest change for me was that you obviously don't have time to do anything for yourself because you're just so focused on like your child and their well-being, and you know, a lot of things take a back seat. But there's still this like intense pressure, you know, whether it's from yourself or the media and kind of these standards that we have in life and our culture in the US. But there's just this kind of intense pressure to like do all the things and to do all of them really well. So I'm a working mom. My husband also has a demanding full-time job, whereas he felt like he had to get up every day and go to work and work long hours. I felt like I had to do that, but also get up in the middle of the night with the baby and get up early and, you know, continue to breastfeed and figure out how to make that work with the demanding travel schedule for work. And I just don't think that that same pressure exists for fathers. And whether we do it to ourselves and kind of internalize that or it comes from the outside, it's still there. But then I think that there's something really magical and special when you're able to kind of like look at your child and really appreciate everything they bring into your life. And I think it makes you realize like nobody's perfect. You can't do every single thing. You could just try your best. And maybe all of that, you know, like all those sleepless nights and the hard times are kind of worth it.
We're talking about the different ways motherhood affects women's health. Let's take a look at a group of moms facing a lot of additional pressures, women who give birth while incarcerated. For them, birth and the hours afterwards are a brief moment of time to connect with their babies before they are separated. There's a new study from Johns Hopkins University that tracked pregnancies and pregnancy outcomes in more than half of the U.S. prison system. In 1 year of the study, 753 babies were born to incarcerated women. Here in Philadelphia, one jail is trying to ease the stress of separation by offering a program that keeps one part of the connection between mother and baby going. Malcolm Burnley has more.
On the warden's desk, there are family mementos and a placard that reads, "I'm not bossy, I'm a boss." Nancy Gianetta is head of Riverside Correctional Facility. That's a county jail in Philadelphia with an inmate population of more than 400, all of them women. The warden walks down an empty corridor and through a series of security doors before entering Unit G.
You going in?
Yeah.
As soon as she enters, the chatter quiets. Nothing happens here without the warden's go-ahead, and she helped get the program up and running.
Ladies, you can resume your activities, all right? Just kind of stay out of the way.
The warden walks to the back of the unit and unlocks a room about the size of a large walk-in closet. Inside, I meet Sierra Jackson.
I'm going to let you guys walk around the unit, but I'll be here if you need me.
Thanks.
Sierra is 27 and has four kids. That's the sound of her pumping milk for her youngest, a new baby girl. She has a cloth draped over her chest, and she's wearing a black hijab and fresh white sneakers.
Your sneakers are really nice, too.
Thank you. I'll board them off for...
In September, Sierra delivered her baby at the hospital. She gave birth to a healthy daughter, Umaya. But there was a bench warrant out for Sierra's arrest stemming from an assault charge, and that's when reality set in. She knew she was headed to jail.
When I was in the hospital, I was so depressed. Like, I didn't want to eat or, like, sleep because they told me that, I was being taken away from her. I was so depressed going through postpartum because I didn't know like how I would see my baby.
At the hospital, a corrections officer told Sierra about a program inside the jail that lets moms supply breast milk to their babies. At Riverside, Sierra enrolled and became one of six nursing mothers in the program. It's one of the first of its kind in the country inside a county jail.
Like being in a lactation program, when I come in here, it's like a clear mind. I breast pump and then like go back out there three times a day. I really love the program.
About a dozen jails nationwide now allow women to pump breast milk behind bars. The idea is to prevent painful engorgement or swelling of the breasts. In other words, a policy of pump and dump. Not at Riverside. Here, mothers are taught breastfeeding education. They're allowed hand pumps and storage bags in their cells. There's an on-site nurse and doula for consultation. And here's the big difference. The refrigerated milk gets transported to their babies on the outside. The program encourages a healthy start for the children, and it's about the physical and psychological well-being of the moms.
And then also they provide a lot of feedback when they get back to the jail. So they'll take pictures of the baby and the caregiver, and they'll talk about the baby and kind of let them know, and maybe there are other children that are in the home. So it really helps the mother feel like in some way she's participating in that whole process of getting the milk to her baby, which is kind of cool.
That's Colette Green from the Maternity Care Coalition in Philadelphia. Women who breastfeed are less likely to develop certain cancers, and moms who breastfeed help boost their child's immune system to better fight off respiratory and digestive problems. Colette believes the bond between mother and child can be strengthened even when mom is physically apart, behind bars. Jail lactation programs can also introduce the practice to women who perhaps never considered its benefits before.
So once they get that information, they really respond very positively and really want what's best for their child.
That's true for the mom we met, Sierra Jackson. She didn't breastfeed her first three children, but now she's asking a nurse to Google the price of breast pumps for her.
I would still have some type of connection with my daughter. We would still have some type of connection through the like milk. I never wanted the breast pump. When none of my kids, they all had formula.
The number of incarcerated women who participated in lactation programs is small, but researchers are trying to study the long-term impact of breastfeeding. A recent study involved almost 140 new mothers who nursed their children behind bars. When researchers checked in over 3 years, those women were 50% less likely to return to incarceration. That's compared to women released from the general prison population. For Warden Nancy Giannetta, who helped put the program in place, the data suggests there's an incentive for correctional departments to keep moms connected to their babies.
So I think that a lot of these programs that are done here within the prison system itself are geared towards outside, living outside the walls so that they can continue on the right path when they're out on the street.
The hope is that moms will take these habits into their lives after jail. Sierra Jackson was released from Riverside in January, shortly after I met her. And she's still pumping for her daughter.
That was Malcolm Burnley. He reports on women's health and economic insecurity for the Fuller Project for International Reporting. We're talking about the impact of motherhood on women's health. When Hurricane Maria hit in September 2017, the healthcare system in Puerto Rico fell apart. Many of the hospitals were not prepared for a disaster like this, and they either closed their doors entirely or they had to limit services they offered to patients. Imagine giving birth as all of this is happening. Now, one doctor wants to prepare pregnant women in case they go into labor during a storm. Irina Zhurov brings us this story from Puerto Rico.
Yahaira Molina Perez was 8 months pregnant when Hurricane Maria hit. In her town of Cedra, downed trees and electric lines made roads impassable after the storm. Yahaira says she wasn't too worried. She wasn't due for weeks. But just in case, her husband, Raul Malave Coto, who owns a landscaping business, took his front loader and started to clear the debris.
So at least the hospitals would be accessible if an emergency occurred.
Yahaira planned to deliver in a hospital in San Juan, about 45 minutes away. She figured storm cleanup would be done by then. Then, 5 days after the storm, she started having contractions. The trip to San Juan took twice as long as usual because the roads were such a mess.
Pero justo cuando llego,
but as soon as we arrive, I see the whole first floor full of sand because the hospital in San Juan is near the beach. It's full of sand. I see broken glass. I climbed the stairs because the elevator is damaged, and the floor where they're attending to pregnant women was dark. And the nurses had their pants and sleeves rolled up because there was no air conditioning.
The hospital was only attending to emergencies, and Yahaira wasn't quite ready to give birth. Raul and Yahaira drove home to Cedra. There, they stopped at Yahaira's mom's house, and Yahaira's water broke.
I was thinking, wow, I did not prepare for this. I never even considered giving birth at home.
There were no phones, no communication, but a doula they'd worked with lived nearby, and she came over. Someone fetched a pediatrician cousin of Raul's. Through the grapevine, they heard an obstetrician lived in the neighborhood and knocked on his door. He brought his wife, a nurse.
I didn't have my medical file with me. In other words, if at any point the doctor asked me something about my condition, I didn't know what to tell him.
The emergency generator roared, another reminder of the chaos outside. It all made her anxious.
I was yelling out of fear. I wasn't yelling because of pain. I yelled from fear.
But this is a happy story. After a brief labor, Raul Leandro was born healthy.
Raul Leandro was a long-awaited child. We waited for him 10 years. And look how he arrived.
The 1.5-year-old is squirming in his father's arms and pointing into the lush jungle that grows just beyond the family's hilltop house. Where is the bobcat? His father asks. The bobcat in question is not a large cat, but the front loader Raul used to clear the roads after the storm. Yahaira says it's her son's most favorite thing in the world. This toddler was one of the unplanned home births that happened in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Obstetrician and gynecologist Carmen Zoria says she heard several stories about babies born outside the hospital. And that worried her.
for these women, this was a stressful situation. So that was my eye-opening experience.
Carmen works at the main public hospital in San Juan. About 6 years ago, she introduced an untraditional approach to care for women with risky pregnancies. The first of its kind in Puerto Rico, the model relies on group prenatal appointments rather than one-on-ones. It's called Centering Pregnancy. Hurricane Maria disrupted many things on the island, and the program was on hiatus. But Carmen is restarting the sessions and thinks they can be adapted to teach hurricane preparedness. At a recent appointment, 9 pregnant women, each with a support person, file into a small room in the hospital.
They come and they weigh themselves and tell the nurse, okay, my weight is this. They take their own blood pressure with a monitor. So they are taking care of their own health right then by weighing themselves and telling the nurse their weight. So they are empowered, they are involved in their care.
Today, the group is discussing common irritations during pregnancy. The facilitator, Dianca Sierra Vega, hands out cards, each with a different aggravation written on it. She tells them to act them out, charade style. One of the women lets out an angry grunt. Mood swings, Dianca confirms after the women guess. I get them, one woman says. I can't even stand myself. They act out headaches, swollen feet, aching backs, constipation. Dianca and Carmen explain the science of what's happening to their bodies. It's informal, the women are engaged and friendly.
That's part of what they gain, and being part of a group, there's social support.
Initially, gynecologist Carmen Zoria introduced group appointments to Puerto Rico because the island has very high rates of babies born too early and underweight. Studies show when moms participate in group appointments, more babies are born closer to their due dates and at healthier weights. No one knows exactly how the groups work, but Carmen thinks they reduce stress, which can hurt both moms and babies. As this storm season approaches, she'll use the model to teach hurricane preparedness.
And in that session, we're going to discuss cases, and we're going to talk about how do you prepare for unplanned home delivery? How do you cut the cord? What things could you have?
Like clean towels, extra medication, water. The women will practice calming breathing exercises. Each expectant mom will receive a copy of her files in case she finds herself delivering outside her regular hospital. The idea is to give the women practical know-how as well as the confidence to stay calm if, say, a storm barrels toward the island.
The concept of group prenatal care is basically you're in control of your health. And having the information of what to do with an emergency labor and delivery, I think gives them peace of mind.
Carmen did something similar during the height of the island Zika epidemic. She put all the diagnosed women together in a group and worked to address their concerns, something she thinks helped moms cope. Yaisha Roja is one of the women in today's group. This is her second pregnancy, and she's due in October, hurricane season. She's all in.
One should always take precautions. Perhaps there's a hurricane, and there aren't many hospitals open. There's traffic. That's why this is important.
She's all for getting pregnant women ready for an emergency, but OBGYN Carmen Zoria does not support scheduled home births. She thinks they're dangerous, but she acknowledges that even the hospitals struggled after Hurricane Maria. Carmen was on duty in the labor room after the storm. There was no water, and she only had 3 sterile C-section kits.
Because of the experiences with Maria, the experience was ingrained into our psyche. And I say that we have like community PTSD. Now that we live not just a hurricane, but the aftermath, the complete disruption of the power grid, everybody's concerned. And now we know that we need to be ready for this.
That story was reported by Irina Zhorov, and it was made possible in part by the Fund for Environmental Journalism of the Society of Environmental Journalists. Our episode is about the impact of pregnancy and motherhood on women's health, and we asked all of you to share your thoughts on this topic. Here's another recording we received.
Hello, my name is Joanna Footman, age 38. Yes, I'm 38. I am a mom and a wife, but I am a mom of two sweet boys, age 6 and a 16-month-old. With my first one in my early 30s, I was just raring to go. I had energy. And then my husband and I, we waited a little bit longer until we had our second son. Are you going to say hi?
Hi.
That's my youngest, Jeremiah. Say hi.
Hi.
Jeremiah was a difficult pregnancy. And he was harder on my body. He was also heavier than his brother. But I know after I had Jeremiah, I think trying to adapt to having two kids and keeping up with my 6-year-old son and trying to be a mom to an infant, even though you have all the help in the world, your kids look to mommy. And both my kids are very attached to their mother, which is a blessing and a curse at the same time. That's such a blessing. Are you a blessing? Yeah. Say yes. Say I'm a blessing. So it's still taking me. I mean, he's almost 2 and I'm still trying to bounce back from having him. Almost 2 years ago, I had knee problems after I had him, feet problems. I'm generally a healthy person, but it took my body a little bit longer to heal because with my boys, I have to keep up with them. They're my motivation for me and my husband to get up in the morning, even if they are the ones looking at us in our face and standing on our head or screaming in the monitor. The point of it is, yes, has it affected me? Of course. But does it stop me? No way, because I am a mother and that's what I'm here for.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Julian Harris is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.